Hey, have you seen the headlines? The whole world is on fire inside esports, everybody's losing their job and their bubble has burst and everything's going down in flames, or potentially not. Everybody thinks that they're an expert as what's happening inside esports teams. You see a lot of articles, you see a lot of hot takes on Twitter, LinkedIn, socials, etc. So I thought, hey, who better to get on board to do an audio space than a guy who leads one of the biggest esports teams in the world, other than Alex from Enthusiast Gaming, leading as the head of Luminosity. We have a chat about how they're doing business, how he thinks things are operating. We talk about redundancies in the market. We talk about revenue. We talk about player management, salaries for both players and of top executives and other workers in the space, and how we think things could be improved or changed. So hopefully enjoy this discussion. I learn a lot. I think you should too.
You know, my first burning question for you, Alex, we talked about this a bit. I think we talked about this a little bit in DMs and a little bit publicly, but I'm really interested to see your take as the head of an esports team, the fit of mega influencers in an esports team. Like, for a while, it was going nuts where there was people part of everything. Like, once upon a time, Ninja was part of Luminosity as well, right? You know, XQC was, you know, and you're seeing a lot of other esports teams. NRG had a whole bunch of mega influencers. And it seems that the only mega influencer-based orgs that are left really are kind of FaZe and 100 Thieves. Do you think maybe it's a trend that's passed? Or, yeah, I'll shut up and I'll let you talk about it.
Yeah, I mean, I think it goes alongside trends more than anything, right? So a while back, everyone wanted to work with the biggest creators and just reaching the absolute most eyeballs possible. And throughout the last few years, we've been hearing a lot about those micro influencers, right? These smaller creators that have really strong communities. So I don't think that trend of mega influencers is dead necessarily. I think it just has slowed down a little bit, but it also comes along with the game, right? You know, I think when you mentioned NRG, I don't think you mentioned Sentinels, but they had Booga for a while, and obviously he blew up alongside Fortnite. So I don't think it's gone. I think it's just, you know, it's going to go through the same trends that the rest of the industry does, where it's not a requirement to have a large influencer on your team. You could have a lot of those same results with a lot of smaller influencers or mid-sized creators or anything in between.
Yeah, that makes sense to me. I think we all know how expensive it can get pretty fast too, right? Like, for me, it's like effective spending of your money. Like, where can you spend it on marketing? And it seems like in the past, most of these orgs were using these mega influencers to try to audience fan transfer, right? Or on-sell sponsorship or for other means. But, you know, if you can't make it work financially as well, that might be a reason to move on, I assume.
Yeah, I mean, it also depends on the creator being the right fit for the brand, right? And I think for a lot of these creators that are on that scale, on that size, the paycheck an organization is going to pay them, although might be substantial to the organization, might not be substantial as a source of revenue for them, right? It's just one of the many others that they have. So when working with creators that size, I think it's more so about just having the right fit and making sure that they're buying into your vision. So I think when you see stuff like that, it's when you'll see creators establish long-term relationships with some of the esports and gaming brands. And then, you know, as some games come out of popularity, maybe those relationships don't stick around much longer, and, you know, it'll again go with the trends of what brands are looking for from the size of creator, but also for the games those creators are in, what type of content they're making, and all that.
Yeah, that makes sense. I mean, like, you know, I helped do the Ghost and Exit partnership many, many years ago, and the peak case study I always mentioned to them when you're talking about creators and esports team was FaZe and G Fuel. I felt like FaZe was G Fuel and G Fuel was FaZe, and it penetrated much deeper than just like CSGO pros being paid to have the logo on their jersey. You know, they had flavors with Rug, and, you know, they had flavors with so many of the top talent, and they just seemed to talk about it organically quite often. And I always wonder that with these kind of semi-external creators, like how much, a lot of the time, like how much do they really care about the esports brand that they're attached to, or do they just see it as someone else that they're, you know, they're obligated to promote, just like if they had Logitech to give them a keyboard or something like that.
Yeah, exactly. I think that's why you'll see a lot of these larger creators maybe step away from some of the gaming and esports brands, and they might just either launch their own project or launch their own products, which is kind of the newest craze. But if the creator actually buys into what that org is doing and maybe the games that org is built around, then I think it gives them a lot of incentive to stay if there's the right relationship there. And it's, you know, I think any good relationship with your creators and your esports teams is not having it feel like a chore, like you said. But, you know, you mentioned specifically on the sponsor front, and that's a whole nother piece of it, right? Like, I think that relationship should extend to sponsors too. Like, none of these creators want to do the typical stand in front of the camera and talk about the features of the product and why they like it so much. They want to do it in a much more like authentic way. I hate to use that word because it's the one everyone always throws around, but it's true, right? Like, if you make the creator's life easy and they get to endorse products in ways that they want to, then they'll always be more willing to do so. And thus, you know, team is happy, the creator's happy, the brand is happy, and everyone kind of wins.
I think for some insight for some people too, because we're talking about, you know, trying to cover costs of creators and how they attach with brands, and people might be, and there might be a bit disconnected as to why that matters. I think from my experience, I've seen esports orgs pay creators anywhere from, you know, $10,000, well, anywhere from $0 up to like $40,000 a month just to be a part of an esports organization. So that's to kind of quantify, like, this is why I'm talking at it from this angle. have you seen kind of similar?
Yeah, I think those numbers massively vary, obviously, depending on the size of the creator, but also on, like, I think one of the big things now is like the categories that you're going to work with, right? Like, I think we've seen some contracts leaked throughout the past few years of like the creator has no categories, and then there's some teams where the creator has all the categories, and you're really just paying for that affiliation. So somewhere in the middle of those is probably really where you want to be. I think all or none is a little bit extreme, but as we see a lot of orgs enter the space and then exit the space as, you know, they run out of money or, you know, get funding pulled or whatever it may be, I think most of the teams that are sticking around are finding, you know, creative ways to make these partnerships work, not just on the esports front, but also with creators.
Mm. Yeah, you're definitely right on the, you know, what you can use the creators for front. And I think something that I saw a lot with esports teams when, you know, creators first started becoming a thing, what I found is creators were pissed off at the esports orgs and the esports orgs were pissed off at the creators. And usually it's just because I think it wasn't a good deal for anyone. You know, like the common, for those people who aren't in gaming, there's a saying called stats pad, which basically means you're like padding out your statistics in a game and making them better by essentially some form of cheating, like joining a empty server with your friend and your friend lets you knife them like 100 times to get your stats up. And what I found a lot of the time is these esports orgs were trying to use small to mid-level Twitch streamers, which at the time were like 20 to, you know, 90 concurrent viewers in these days. They were trying to Pokemon collect as many of those as possible to stats pad their sponsorship report so they could go to Logitech and say, hey guys, sponsor us because we have a combined, you know, 90,000 Twitter followers. But when you look into it, 89,500 of those are from this 600 talent they have signed to their roster, and the rest is actually their esports team. And I had a few streamers come to me upset saying, Chris, you know, I feel like these people are using me. They've only ever given me like one mouse, and I have to tag up as them, and I have to make my Twitter bio as them, and I can't take any other sponsors because of them, you know, et cetera, et cetera. And I think in the end, it just doesn't become a good deal for anyone. So, you know, I think it's not just, and what I'm trying to say is it's not just the mega creators who can and can't work for an org, but I've just seen the strategy of why you would sign creators just seem to be so off for so long for me that there's not a lot of examples that I've seen in the market of creators who are actually good for the brand and brands that are good for the creators.
Yeah, that totally makes sense. And I think that used to happen a lot more maybe, you know, 5-6 years ago. But as the space has professionalized itself a little bit, I think we're getting away from that. And a lot of these creators are trying to find ways where it's mutually beneficial. You know, like we said, for some of the mega creators, getting a bi-weekly or monthly check from a gaming or esports brand might not matter, right? Because they're just making so much money that they have so many revenue streams that it might not matter to them. But for some of those smaller and mid-sized creators that maybe only rely on one social platform, or maybe they only rely on their Twitch subs or their YouTube revenue, having an extra check coming in every month and it's kind of getting a guaranteed income outside of your main platform is a really nice thing to have. I mean, we've kind of seen it throughout the last 3 months, right? The economy's definitely in a weird spot, not just within gaming, but overall. And we see YouTube rates go down. if you're struggling a little bit more financially, maybe you're not subbing to as many people on Twitch. And what does that do to some of the Twitch streamers' sub counts? So knowing that they have the kind of bare minimum coming in day by day, that kind of eases their mind a little bit, I would say, and allows them to really focus on what matters, which is making the best content possible. And at least that's what we look for from our creators, right? How do we allow you to grow and make the best content possible? So you're happy. If you're happy, that allows us to be happy and make our sponsors happy.
Yeah. Yeah, it makes sense to me, man. What else is going on in the world of esports teams? We're seeing some restructures, people lay people off. Everyone's talking about revenue and sustainability. Do you have a top level insight into what's going on in the industry? And then we can dig down into some more specifics.
Yeah. I mean, if you go on Twitter or LinkedIn feeds, it sounds like the world's on fire, but I think that's a pretty negative way to look at it.
Say there's one interesting thing about LinkedIn, because I think we've talked about this before. For so long, there was so much toxic positivity. Like when things weren't working at times, everyone was like, wow, this is amazing. This partnership's the best thing I've ever seen in the entire world. And then now it's like, it's almost like that de-influencing trend. It's kind of gone the opposite. It's like, man, everything's on fire. There's a meteor about to strike into Earth because an esports team furloughed some people after hiring too many.
Yeah, just going in the extreme ends no matter what, which I don't think either of the answers are right. Like things are definitely not going great for the space right now, but I don't think that's an esports or gaming specific issue. I think we have to look at the overall economy and market right now, and it's not specific to gaming or esports. So for there to be some layoffs, like 10 layoffs at a company, and everyone say the world is on fire, but then we see, you know, Microsoft and Meta and all these other companies laying off thousands and thousands of people. So I think it's a bigger than gaming thing. I think most people can agree with that. So I don't like seeing on social all these things of like, esports doesn't work, gaming doesn't work, the bubble has bursted, it was fun while it lasted. That might be true for a few companies that maybe overhired or went too deep into one specific title, or maybe, you know, spent too much on a mega creator, like you mentioned. So I think that's the case for a few companies, not the scene as a whole.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it makes sense to me, man. I think, I think the problems with esports teams have still been clear to us, right, for a long time. And part of it to me, talking to people privately who don't necessarily want to be named, the most interesting thing for me was just how many employees a lot of these esports teams had, you know, raising money, having 150, 200, 250 plus employees. And it's hard to make a one-to-one comparison between other, say like tech or startup companies, because nothing's ever one-to-one. But, you know, when you look at how many employees something like Instagram had when it was acquired, you know, for $1 billion, and that's the goal of most of these esports teams who are raising money, is to become $1 billion esports team. Or you look at other, you know, more service-based organizations that are doing more revenue with less headcount. That's always been an interesting thing to me. It's like, why do they need so many people? Why do you need a social team of 7 people? Like, is it really necessary to be able to operate your esports team, and, you know, et cetera, et cetera?
Yeah, I mean, I think if you look back, some of the biggest properties around right now were built by a handful of people, right? So I don't know why the goal was to go from a handful of people to very quickly scale to 100, 200, 300 employees. And there's only a couple teams that have that many, and some of them might need that many. But I think we'll see most teams scale back, especially on the creative side, I would imagine. I think it's good, though, that teams are now in a position to hire, right? I think it's all about looking at it, not just from the, hey, we've had 2 bad months of people getting laid off from esports teams. If you pull it back to, you know, a 6-7 year horizon, it's like most teams didn't even have full-time employees, right? Most teams were working as independent contractors. The thought of posting a position and hiring someone was not a reality at that time. Except for maybe the biggest of the biggest teams. And now we have, you know, dozens and dozens of teams that employ hundreds of people. So overall, I think we're trending in the right direction. Some teams might have just hit the gas a little too hard, hired maybe too many people, and now they're trying to scale back. I think we've seen a couple teams that maybe laid off a few people in the creative department are now hiring back in some other areas, maybe some partnership and event management and stuff like that. So I think more of a correction than anything. I don't believe that this is going to be a sudden turn back the clock and everyone's running 5 or 10 person teams. It's all a matter of like, you know, what that company needs. But most of the time, what that company needs is not going to be 200 employees to run an esports team.
Yeah. And also not trying to say that those employees weren't important or busy or actually doing work. You know, I don't think they're all just sitting around twiddling their thumbs all day, but it's been something as like a business owner in this space for a while, it's been something that I've focused on a lot is like effective hiring and subcontracting wherever possible and using other agencies wherever possible and using contractors wherever possible. And I just feel like, yeah, when you raise a bunch of money, it's easy to overspend. And there's that old classic, you know, in startup land of potentially raising too much money and getting too comfortable and hiring too many people. You know, maybe that happened, I don't know. But yeah, it's always just been interesting to me seeing like the effective use of, you know, this one influencer, for example, who can maintain, you know, I got a friend of mine who's an influencer who can maintain like 7 YouTube videos a week across multiple platforms and have 3.5 million subscribers in the Minecraft nation, you know, be making about 1.5 million a year in ad revenue by himself without an editor, without anyone else. I'm sure he's burning out a bit, but he could just get one editor for $100, $200 a video to alleviate that. And you compare that to an esports team and how many employees they often need to just make that first $1 million in revenue that he's already making. You know, it's just like, yeah, is it effective use of employees' time, and are you hiring the right people to do the right work? And, you know, do you really need to be posting that much on Twitter, or do you really need to put that much effort into your creative? And, you know, maybe that's why the creative teams were the first to go, because they realized that, hey, we can automate some of these processes and, you know, don't have to have, you know, a camera crew of 6 people to shoot some documentary type footage. We can just get, you know, the FaZe Clan style of holding a small DSLR camera in front of your face, and people enjoy that content just as much.
Yeah. I mean, I think a lot of it has to do with, you know, either an already actualized or an expectation that their, you know, amount of content necessary is going to slow down. Like, I think that's what we saw across a lot of the tech companies, right? That's the consistent narrative of, you know, we thought that this hype of, you know, everyone remote and all this content and everyone online all the time was going to continue. And, you know, we're definitely not at pre-COVID levels, but we've definitely slowed down and taken a little bit of a dip in terms of like, if you look at watch hours across Twitch and YouTube and just about everything, I think it's gone down just a little bit. And that's probably that correction that we're really seeing. And that isn't exclusive to the tech companies, right? That's kind of some of the spill-off that lands in gaming and the creator economy.
Mm. Yeah. Yeah. True, man. What else are you seeing happening in the market at the moment? What's some hurdles that you're trying to overcome, either yourself or you're seeing other esports teams? Like, what's the pain points?
Yeah, I mean, I wouldn't say hurdle, but, you know, I think just as layoffs happen and companies try to save money, I think we're seeing the salaries across esports games go down just a little bit. I think there's always kind of that mentality of next one up, and all these players are fighting for their spot in all of these different leagues and circuits. So teams are taking chances on, you know, younger players or less experienced players if it's a little bit more cost effective. I think we just had Cloud9 make a roster change in Valorant, and then they came out and said, you know, the cost of the player was a factor. It's something that teams have to take into consideration. Because some of these salaries a year ago, 2 years ago, were getting pretty up there, right? Like pretty crazy for some of the top games and what the players were being paid monthly.
Yeah, the return on investment for player salary is an interesting thing, right? Like, I think the first LinkedIn audio space I did was with Jeremy, who, you know, manages a whole bunch of the top CSGO players in the world and also some in League and Rocket League, et cetera. And then also Oliver Tierney, who's at Monster now, but he was a CSGO pro player with Renegades throughout kind of like 2019-2020 season, playing overseas in majors and minors and stuff. And yeah, I asked them the question, like, I was a bit more direct and basically said, are players paid too much? Because it seems to be that the return on investment isn't there, but the market has just ensured that players want to get paid a certain amount, and they've demanded a certain amount, and teams have just paid it because they have. But I feel like now maybe some teams are going back and looking and being like, hey, this you know, player who plays, say, Rocket League, who has 5,000 Twitter followers, even though they are, you know, a top 10 team in the world, is it really worth paying this person $10,000 a month? plus, you know, the other players in the team as well? Like, is it really worth this $300,000 to $500,000 spend on this one Rocket League team? What's the ROI on that?
Yeah, and Rocket League's a great example as, you know, a game that I'm pretty bullish on. But when there's 25 teams competing in North America, right? 25 signed teams, someone ends up getting the short end of the stick. Like, not everyone is paid on the same level, but if you're a top 15 team, you might be getting paid the same as a top 25 team. And so, you know, whoever's in 25th place probably isn't going to be happy with their investment. I mean, person in 15th place might not even be happy with their investment. But I think that's also what's causing a lot of exits and entrances into different games, where it's just, you know, if you're not guaranteed a top team and you're just going to have to get into these bidding wars, it might just not be worth it to try to maintain your spot as one of those top teams when you can enter a game that's maybe a little less competitive in the number of orgs or trying to sign the top players in it, right? These bidding wars is really what has driven up that salary historically. Everyone's saying that, you know, the path to success is having the number one team, which I think is a piece of it, but not necessarily a proven solution, right? Just because you have the number one team doesn't mean that it's going to all of a sudden drive more revenue than the second, third, or fourth best team. So.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, really true, man. Yeah, and I think, you know, Jeremy's answer for that, obviously he has to advocate on behalf of his clients, who are the players. But to me, he seemed to indicate that he's happy asking for that much because the orgs are offering it. And he basically, you know, in a way, without directly saying, if you can't afford to pay us this much money, stop offering us this much money. You know, like if you can't afford to pay, you know, a CSGO, like a top level CSGO team in Australia will cost you $600,000 a year, you know, and they'll come 14th at a major. Like it starts to put into perspective, like, okay, the whole mo money, mo problems thing. Like, sure, if an Australian team can sell, you know, a few hundred grand of sponsorship and maybe lose, you know, $100,000 on an Australian team, well, you just got to 10x that or 20x that for a US team because they've just got 10x the followers, but they're making 10x the losses potentially on a team if they don't do things right.
Yeah, I mean, I think what ends up happening is a lot of, at least historically, right, we've seen new companies go get fundraising or someone makes some sort of side project, someone that has enough money that they want to launch. They say, you know, I'm excited about gaming and esports. I read an article on it in 2017 and I want to launch a team. And then they come in and drive up the salaries. And 2 years later, they say, this wasn't what I really wanted. I don't really want to stay in this space. I'm going to go start up some other company. And they leave. Those salaries don't just disappear or go down. Those salaries have been inflated and have continued to go up throughout the last 5, 6, 7 years. I think this is the first time in a long time that we see salaries going down. And again, probably just part of that natural correction. I think they have a long way to go to get to a healthy spot. But it's good to see that the salaries are correcting alongside teams kind of trying to pull back some of their spend and get to a sustainable part. Because if you're having to lay off employees, but the cost of players keeps going up, then that's not really a healthy spot to be in, because you're going to replace the money you saved by spending it again to maintain those players.
Yeah. Yeah. Makes sense to me, man. If anyone in the audience wants to come up and ask any questions too, or refute what we're saying, call us idiots, whatever you want to do, just click the little raise your hand icon and then we can bring you up and you can have a bit of a chat. Anything else you want to talk about, Alex, before we bring anyone else up? Anything else on your mind?
No, we can jump from question to question and we're about halfway through. Let's start taking some and see where they lead us.
Yeah, man. Sounds good to me. I'm just bringing Tony up. Tony, what's going on, man?
Hey, folks. Thanks for hosting this talk. I'm not in the industry, so this is very insightful. I'm just a fellow gamer and you know, stream watcher. But my question is, I've seen a lot of big streamers sort of break into the industry by creating their own team. I'm just wondering, do you think this is sort of an experiment on their part, or do you think this trend will continue to go and we'll see more big streamers creating their own teams and trying to, you know, and one of the things I've recently watched is from Ludwig, who said, you know, the way to, I guess, in a way, improve revenue streams for esports teams to combine sponsorship deals with some of the big streamers and influencers. I'm just wondering if you can share some insights on that.
Yeah, I guess I can give my perspective, and then I'd love to hear kind of what Chris thinks. But, you know, Ludwig's Moist Esports is a great example where, you know, 5 years from now, that might be the biggest team in the world. I don't think anyone would be surprised if that happens, right? Him and Moist Critical have really large followings, and if they go in on that project and continue putting in the effort, who knows where it can go. But I think many people also wouldn't be surprised if a few years from now they've put a lot of capital into it and they say, you know what, we're going to go a different direction. We're going to do something else. We did it for a bit. This was fun. I think I see it no different than someone else that has the capital to launch a project like that. I guess they have an additional benefit that they have a huge following. So it gives them kind of a jump start, right? They have a foot ahead of everybody else. But Chris, anything else there?
Yeah, I've been thinking about this in my head, so it's could come out as word soup. But so, what you said, Alex, around them becoming disinterested and leaving is interesting to me, because I feel like so much in this conversation today we were talking about maybe teams have raised money and over-professionalized. They've hired too many staff. They've tried to do too many things. They've paid players too much. And what I wonder about the influencers is, are they the opposite? Are they not used to running a business? They're used to being a very small, you know, 1, 2, 3 person operation, and they're not able to professionalize enough to get the structure to be able to make the money back. Like, there are some videos from Moist and et cetera, talking about how much money they lose on their esports team and how much these things actually cost them. And, you know, part of the thing is always, okay, can you sell some sponsorship to make that back? And if you don't have some of those structures in place of those good salespeople, you know, like what Guild Esports has been able to do, say like Jeff Pabst, who was at FaZe, or like Adam Bauer, the chief strategy officer at FaZe, or, you know, Herb from eFuse, like some of these really good, solid salespeople in the space. If you don't have them to back it up, then you're not going to be able to do the sales. Or if you do sell a sponsorship, are you going to be able to fulfill it? Are you going to be able to do all the sponsor obligations that's required with a corporate sponsorship that comes with the, you know, with the $600K to a million to $5 million plus check? Like, you can't just take that money and do nothing. You know, FaZe did a full feature length video on YouTube. Like, they did meetups, or they did parties with rappers for MoonPay at San Diego for TwitchCon, and, you know, et cetera, et cetera. Like, you got to go further than just putting the logo in a video and in a movie. But you do have that first mover's advantage, or like the lower revenue advantage, exactly like what you said, Tony, is combining those sponsorships together. That's definitely helpful. It's definitely something that's happened a lot before with a lot of different brands, which is kind of like sponsor this thing and you get like the esports team for free. There's for example, there's a Taiwanese esports team many years ago that I know of who was owned and named after a distributor of tech products there. And it was much easier for them to get sponsorship because, you know, the tech brands of the world being like, you know, Asus, MSI, et cetera, that, you know, Logitech, Corsair, that kind of category, they want to support the distributor and they want to, you know, in a sales perspective, they want to make sure the distributor's happy. So they're much more likely to sponsor that team over there. So there's different levers pulling on the reasons that they might want to sponsor these teams. And similar to like what Alex said before as well, I know firsthand there's a global brand who sponsors an esports team purely because their board said, what's the biggest prize pool esport game in the world? The answer was Dota. And they said, go sponsor a Dota team. Like, that's the entire reason. So I've kind of jumped all over the place here, but to summarize really in a couple of dot points for me, it's like, are they going to be able to build the structure that can actually make them some money back? Because I don't think they're going to be happy with losing hundreds of thousands of dollars forever just for like an ego play or something like that. And like what Alex said, they get a really easy, quick start to get to a certain level, but it's not an easy quick start to get to a profitability level. There's a lot of structures and things they need to put in place for that to happen. And I would suggest listening to FaZe Rain, has been doing a lot of content recently. He did a podcast with Bradley Martin where he talked about the XX FaZe CEO and how they really fucked them. And this was FaZe trying to go from just a group of, you know, 4 founders and mates trickshotting to a professional company, and they chose the wrong CEO to back them. And that's what I worry too about with a lot of creators. I've seen a lot of creators take on individual managers who've just really fucked them around. Like, I know another mega creator who got managed by some guy. He joined, convinced him all this stuff, started like 6 lawsuits and then left, like on behalf of the creator, you know, kind of talked him into it. And things like that too. So that's also what I worry is about. Yeah, can they professionalize and you know, be able to turn a profit without having, you know, business experience to do that. And then if they pick the business people, do they pick the right ones? And it's a tale as old as time, you know, influencers getting the wrong managers, the same as, you know, you hear the old story of bands using their uncle to be their agent and just not representing them properly, you know, as they grow up.
So Chris, I think when Tony joined, he asked, like, is it pretty much just an experiment? I would say he's kind of spot on, right? I guess we'll probably look back in 2-3 years and find out if the experiment worked.
Yeah, in short, yes. I think it is. Because I think they see what they can do so much better than esports teams. You know, like I said, my mate who has zero employees and he's on a computer that I got sponsored for him is making like $1 to $1.5 million a year. Like $1 to $1.5 million a year at like 22 years old with zero employees. You know, how many esports organizations not in the tier one, in the tier two are struggling and would, you know, murder someone to make $1 million in revenue a year. And he's got, you know, millions and millions of fans, which a lot of these esports teams want, you know, they're hanging out for his every video, for his every tweet, for his every merch drop, things like that too. So there are things that creators do so much better than esports teams. But yeah, I just wonder about the structures that are in place to be able to actually do that. Because when you start talking, this is like a podcast that he'd used and years ago with someone, they were talking with esports. They were like, yeah, how do we get like proper money? I'm not talking like a $500,000 sponsorship or even a $5 million. Like, how do we get a $50 million multi-year sponsorship for an esports team? And that takes like another level. But it's getting that way where you have to do that to actually be able to turn any sort of profit. You know, FaZe's books are public. You can just take a look at that, for example, as to what they need to do just to be able to turn a profit in the future. They need to sell more than their, you know, $1, $2, $5, $10 million deals. They really need to someday be able to sell like a $50 million.
Amazing. Thank you both for the answer. I think this is really extensive and I certainly learned a lot. And thanks for inviting me up here.
No worries, man.
Thanks for coming up.
James, I'm sure you've got some questions, my friend. You got to raise your hand, surely. Yeah, here we go. He's the common question asker, James Fudge.
We love James. I'll
bring him up. Don't grill him. Don't grill him too hard, James.
I'm not going to. Hey, Alex, how you doing?
Hey, buddy. How's it going? Nice to talk again.
That sounds sinister from the first second.
No. You do like Joe.
I like Alex all the time. So yeah. I like Alex. That's good. He's a good guy. I was talking to somebody that does, and he's in the audience here, about, you know, what production teams at esports are capable of, and one thing he noted is that a lot of them get sponsorship deals that they have to deal with, but they don't actually know how to make a commercial or, you know, make an ad or do those kinds of things. Do you think that that's part of the problem with sponsorships and maybe them not being as effective as they could be?
Yeah, I mean, I think on some of the smaller teams that have maybe not scaled yet, that might be kind of the hole for them, right? So for them, a sponsorship might be, well, we're going to put your logo on all the social headers and on the jerseys, and we're going to tweet about it once per month. That might have gotten the job done in 2015 or 2016. To your point, everyone's looking to scale a little bit bigger now, and as Chris said, not only are companies looking to scale bigger, but teams want to scale bigger. And the ones that are able to and are able to take these larger budget deals and create larger budget events are going to be the ones that have success. Because like you said, a $1 million, $2 million, $5 million deal might not get it done anymore. I mean, you're looking for those bigger prizes and the ones who can do a little bit more than the bare minimums and put together these really cool concepts are going to be the ones that are successful. So I guess, James, yeah, like there are teams that for sure struggle with that. The ones who don't have the experience and haven't done it before and you know, their first few brand deals, the customer might not be happy with what they get because they've never done it before. And they might say they're able to do it and then just not execute. Kind of what Chris referenced earlier, right? Like having the right team around you to be able to professionalize a little bit in the areas that matter and execute.
Hmm. Yeah, I talked to the owner of a major sporting code in Australia about exactly this. You know, it was his opinion that you know, esports teams deserve a lot more sponsorship, but also it was his opinion that they just can't run the sponsorships or report on the sponsorships very well at all. And they're just missing most of that professional acumen that's required that comes with, you know, selling a Toyota or a Coca-Cola at that, you know, multi seven figure level. So yeah, it's backed up, you know, by Alex, by what I think, but also what people outside of esports think looking in as well.
Let me ask you another question real quick. Are sponsors looking for more for less, given, you know, the state of the economy and whatnot? And, you know, maybe they view the sector as kind of weak, so maybe some of them are taking advantage.
I wouldn't say so. I think sponsors are more so looking to replicate what works, right? I think that this isn't a time where many are going to go out and try something completely new. You know, I think on the esports front specifically, we're not going to see what I had mentioned earlier, right? We're not going to see brands that are like handing over a giant check to just be on an esports jersey or things that might not have worked for them in the past. I think we're going to see a lot of them still. I think there's still a completely growing interest in esports and gaming in general, but maybe, you know, trying to replicate some of what has been done in traditional sports or in other areas and bringing that to esports and gaming, right? Think influencer marketing. It's no different whether it's in the beauty industry or in the gaming industry, whether it's a live streamer or someone that's only making VOD on YouTube. Like, I think brands are going to go back to old reliable, right? What has worked for them in the past and kind of play it a little bit slow, at least this year.
Yeah, I've seen this happening. I've seen this happening for a bit already. I talked to a T1 esports team sales director about this in person a few times. And what I saw from my agency work in the past 3 years is more brands are asking for more direct ROI. And an esports team can't always provide direct ROI. Like, I had someone senior from Astralis on my podcast years ago, and he said, you know, quote, like in quotation marks, "We are not a CPM company." And that's probably the end of the quotes. And it was along the lines of, you know, we sell a feeling and we sell, you know, attachment to our brand and what we can perform on the global esports stage and the passion that's required and stuff around that. You know, when an esports team, you know, using the Rocket League example, when they're playing in the RLCS, there's no direct pathway to purchase for like RAM or a graphics card or, you know, a beauty product or anything like that, right? It's more like exposure and brand attachment than it is direct ROI. But I'm seeing more and more brands want that direct ROI, and maybe a way to do that is by using influencers, which is where Alex and I started the conversation, and doing ad roles with them and sponsor slots and tweets, et cetera.
I just want to say one thing: that rumor about Riot allowing gambling sponsors, not true. So you can kick me out now.
I mean, it makes sense. Hey, there were two people with their hand raised, but now they're both gone.
Yeah, I just saw that also. I don't know whose names it was, but put your hands back up so we can.
Here we go. We got one. Bring one guy. Hey, James, was that it from you?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, obviously, I really would like to see like all the owners of these teams get together, maybe, and say, okay, let's cut some salaries for some of these players, because it's not, you know, most of the people I've talked to have said it's not profitable at all. So it's just a loss leader. So they got to figure it out or find a way to pay for it. One of the two.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's all I have.
Thanks, James.
Can you imagine a picture of Alex and Nade Shot and FaZe Banks and everyone together, and it's like a selfie picture and it's a meeting? You know, we're talking about how to remove salaries. I don't think that would go too well. I don't know. Although I am trying to make an event. Well, I am making an event for senior industry people during E3 time in LA, just waiting on approval from the venue for a T1 esports team in there. So I'm hoping we can actually have some of these discussions there. I'm really hoping we can get FaZe and 100 Thieves and Luminosity and EG and, you know, Cloud9, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, into a room together to discuss some of this stuff.
I think Martha was,
yep, just up there send her a request. Martha, hey.
Hi. Thank you so much for this overview. I've really learned an incredible amount, and I appreciate your guys' time. I'm curious, just from the legal perspective, I practice in the data privacy, cybersecurity, and tech and commercial transaction space. And I'm wondering, what kinds of emerging legal issues are you guys seeing, particularly because this is such a young industry, and are there specific issues that that keep you guys up at night?
NFTs is probably one of them. I think, I don't know if you've been tracking it, but a lot of stuff with Logan Paul and Crypto Zoo, and there's a lot more NFT stuff coming down the pipeline. I think there's a lot of esports and gaming influencers that got caught up in the whole craze, but I think CoffeeZilla explains it well, and he's a channel to follow if you're not already. He's the biggest in the space, and Scott Schaefer is another fantastic one, and Patrick Boyle is a third one. I'd follow them in that order to learn a bit about this stuff. But like as CoffeeZilla said, is that it's no longer it's not as hands-off as just promoting a brand, and maybe NordVPN isn't as good as they said it was. It's like they've been taking money from people under the guise of investment to make their money, and they're not delivering. That's been happening quite often. So it's going to be interesting to me to see, you know, who certain people choose to make a case out of. And I've heard that specifically in Australia, where I live, that the authorities have been looking for a bit here to make a case out of someone. And I don't know if that's specifically in gaming or whatever else, but just that general theme is interesting, and not interesting in a good way, because a lot of people lost money.
Absolutely. Thanks so much.
Yeah. I guess outside of NFTs, I think it's gotten better throughout the last few years, but a few years ago, we saw a lot of the contract disputes on, you know, contractors versus full-time employees. And then I think we mentioned a little bit earlier on the chat that we talked about, you know, what categories are protected by players, what categories will their agents still sell on their behalf. Like, I think overall contracts have gotten a lot better in the space, you know, as more experienced agencies get involved, as players have more experience signing contracts, as teams get more experienced. I think we're getting away from a lot of those disputes, but still almost every month we see something pop up from a few years back of someone that feels that, you know, they didn't get what they signed up for, or that they were done wrong by a team.
Yeah, so same in a lot of industries, but it's interesting to see it, you know, from the perspective of an industry that's just kind of taking off so quickly.
If you're looking for someone to follow in that sense too, Martha, on Twitter, Ryan Fairchild would be a really good person to follow in there, a good friend of mine and an esports lawyer who deals a lot with contracts for players and influencers.
Awesome. Thank you. That's it.
Cool. No worries. Zach, we had someone else had their hand raised who put it down. But no, Zach, what's going on, man?
Hello. What's going on, guys? Hey, my question is kind of what you were talking about, Chris, is like I'm always assessing what is the return on any kind of expenditures I make and any kind of, you know, freelancers I bring on for projects and things like that. And I was thinking about orgs and how it seems like they really overinflated on hiring, of course. And then a lot of people are saying that they underdelivered. I mean, I don't know who or, you know, how often, but it seems like they underdelivered on some promises to sponsors. I'm curious if a small org is out there and is trying to figure out the best way to build this, to build their staff, hypothetically, would it make more sense, seeing as there's agencies for so many different services that an esports team might need, would it make sense for there to just be like a smaller bare bones staff, but kind of like, you know, in the agency world, we'd call them like producers that are just used to going out and hiring this type of service and that type of service. So everything from legal to marketing to content creation, it's like, would that potentially make more sense to outsource almost everything except for the players themselves, the coaches, you know, stuff that's based around the actual esport? Or
I have done that before. We did a multi seven figure game launch last year with a client of mine, and it finished with the world's largest VR esports event in Miami, which is where Alex came and Jake Lockie was there, and we got to catch up together. And we had for that total campaign, we had somewhere in the vicinity of, I mean, not including esports, because you can get a lot of subcontractors there for like vision and sound and security and cleaning and whatever, but not including esports, using various subcontractors. We had probably about 9, I think, for that campaign. We had like a paid media ads agency who also did creative. We had 2 PR agencies, one for B2B and one for B2C. We had a niche VR influencer agency, et cetera, et cetera. We worked with a lot of different people for that project. So it worked for us, and we've done that a bit, and we've done it on the other side as well. We just passed off a gambling client recently to a friend of ours to do, but we were the subcontracted in that case. And actually the first ever project I did in esports as a consultant, I was a subcontractor for a property opening up in Australia. You know, it was just like a $5,000 deal for me to do some presentations and my thoughts on, you know, the viability of it and some of the direction that I thought they should go. So yeah, it's definitely something I've done from both sides of the value chain before. And I think it can work. It's just a lot of processing and having the right knowledge and connections. And it can be hard because it's hard to know who are the right people to choose to do this work, and then being able to sync them all together, multi-different companies, different payment terms. And contractually, that's where a lot of the stress comes from as well, is you have a parent contract and then you're trying to subcontract these people. What happens if your parent contract cuts you off, or the sponsor doesn't pay on time, or things like that? That can be pretty concerning. And that was stressful for us because we're taking on, you know, that was our largest client and it was quite a large liability. You know, just what happens if the client doesn't pay us and we owe the esports tournament production company $200,000.
Right.
So that's always a concern. And our name is on the contract, not the client, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm more so thinking like from the org side. I mean, you had touched on that a little bit, but I'm just thinking like, you know, if Nadeshot was starting 100 Thieves today and he just had the players and then his own kind of influencer relations, obviously he's got a small team of content creators and things like that. But going from there, what if they had kept it real small, even when they got the Cash App compound and, you know, just hired outside people for all that? But
yeah, it's all interesting. I think hindsight's 20/20 for a lot of these companies, right? Where
for sure,
you have all these new opportunities coming in, so you scale super quickly. And not only does that put you in the situation that a lot of teams are in right now, but also that I think you referenced when you hopped on that, you know, sometimes the projects didn't come out well for some companies or some clients weren't happy. But when you go from maybe 2 projects a month to all of a sudden 10, and you're hiring all these people and trying to do all these onboarding, it's likely things will fall through the cracks. Just it's, you know, those totally, growth pains. Right. But I think we will see a shift towards a lot of teams using agencies again or using contractors again. You know, I don't believe everyone's, like I said in the beginning, for those that were on, like, I don't think everyone's going to suddenly scale back down to 10 employees or 5 employees. But I think everyone is going to correct. A lot of that is going to come on the creative side, not just, you know, because of having to cut costs, but because of lack of projects for them to do, right? If you don't have the sponsorships rolling through, or if you don't have the brand deals coming in, then there's just maybe a little bit less to do and you have to kind of pull back a little bit.
Yeah, for sure. Thank you, guys.
So good, man. I think one of the best examples of like what you just said, Alex, is Paper Crowns. They do content for everything from individual influencers.
Are awesome. Yeah,
they do everything from individual influencers to like Call of Duty League. You know, COD League isn't even hiring awesome. Their own internal creative, you know, from top to bottom. They're using externals too. So yeah, why can't other people? I feel like the past, you know, as I've been an agency, I feel like the past four to 6 years has really been the rise in niche agencies. There's been a lot of more maybe distrust in the larger, more blue chip style agencies. And if you're looking for something more specific, like Gen Z TikTok promotion, or, you know, specific types of satire creative, or you're looking for esports help, then you go to a niche agency and you either do that through the big agency you contract, or you do it directly through another one. And then you've got multiple of these agencies working together. And, you know, and now to get even more meta, you've got a lot of these esports teams operating as agencies. But I want to ask you something, Alex. What's your thought on what's your thought on all these esports team offices that have been opened up? I have a friend who's always worked remote, but very high level in the industry, but kind of behind the scenes. Not a lot of people, I think, would know who he is. But he has been looking for a job for maybe 12 months now, and he said no esports team will hire him remotely. they all want them to come into the office. And it's his, he wrote a big article about it. I'm not sure if he's published it or not, but it's his theory that they've just way overspent on these massive offices and they just need to get people in there to show the VC that their staff are real.
They're trying to justify the cost of their rent.
Yeah. Yeah. So you agree? So you agree as well? Yeah,
no, I don't know if I agree. I hoped companies wouldn't do that, but I don't think there's a need for it to be in office. Like I don't think many teams benefit from that. I think if you look at 100 Thieves, they're a good example that probably does benefit from it because they have this massive compound. But then again, like teams like that could probably survive with just their creative team in office, right? I don't know if you necessarily need every single member there on a consistent basis. If you're an esports manager and your team doesn't live, you know, like let's not use 100 Thieves as an example, right? But if you weren't based in LA and you had a League of Legends team, what benefit would it be for you to be in a Dallas office? Like, and I'm sure there's a lot of teams in situations like that where their players aren't local, their players aren't playing out of the office, and they're just an esports manager or something along those lines. You know, you can get a smaller office then essentially. You don't need all the space for all of your employees to be there. I think it'll mostly be centered around the content and creative team, and then producers, directors, any talent management that would go alongside that if the talent was local. But I don't know. Some of the biggest teams in the world haven't had offices. You know, you mentioned FaZe. They're, for the first time, they have that huge warehouse, right? So I know they had some offices in the past that weren't super public, and then I think we're for the most part done with team houses in 2023. There's still a few team houses here and there, but I don't know. I don't think in office is something that most teams are going to stick with, at least long term.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it makes sense to me, man. I've done both with my company, being in office and out of office too. The hardest thing for me in our industry is that a lot of the employees are junior. And it's really hard to train people who are remote. They don't pick up on a lot of things. There's not the social thing there. They don't learn, you know, a lot of the office etiquette stuff. And it's much harder to train. And it's just not the same, like sharing your screen on Slack and talking through things, as it is in person. You know, it's easy to misinterpret things that are said over text and stuff like that too. And I haven't had any major issues, but I've just found like training. You know, I've always tried throughout my career to have a lot of time for junior employees or for interns and stuff. You know, Thermaltake had two interns and they've both been quite successful in the industry since then, thankfully. But I just haven't found the same ability to train and upskill people while working remotely as I have in person. And that's the major thing that I miss with that.
Yeah, I think that's totally fair point. We've got a few minutes left, Chris. Do we want to find one more question?
Yeah, man. Yeah. Funnily enough, the only messages I've gotten all talk has been when I talked about remote. I just had two people message me about working remote. Yeah. And still, by the way, I love it. Like I worked for Corsair 2 years remote. I worked for Thermaltake 4 years in an office. I was a journalist for remote a year and a half. So I really have done both. Like my entire working life, I've done about 50-50, I think, in office and remote. But I don't know which one I prefer more. It's so easy to get, even for me as the owner of the business, it's so easy to get distracted working remotely as well. So yeah, a bit of both. Oh, no, we just had Jamil put his hand up again.
Too many AI updates, Chris, distracting you?
Dude, GPT-4 just came out. And actually, yeah, some of the stuff is crazy. I don't know if you saw, there's like a, you can now upload an image and it will tell you what's wrong with the image. So
they got to sign up based on that when GPT-4 came out yesterday. They got me to sign up for, I forget what they're calling it. They're calling it GPT Plus, and it's like $20 a month. So they got, yeah, they got me.
Dude, it's crazy.
I think we had Jamil up here, but
yeah, his hand raised again, but it disappeared before I could click accept. Jamil, I don't know if you are there. Here we go. 10th time lucky. Let's go.
Hey guys.
Hey, man.
Just a question before we wrap up. A lot of talk has been coming out that esports teams are not sustainable financially, the ROI is not positive, stuff like that. And I see that a lot of it's headed in the direction of you need brand deals to stay afloat and to be sustainable. Do you think, especially with the rise of content creators buying teams or creating their own teams, do we see something like, you know, how Mr. Beast, for example, did their own like brand or products? Will they cross-sell that with influencers in order to kind of offset the need for brand partnerships and sponsorships?
Yeah, I think Chris and I could probably talk for a whole hour on that, but we'll probably land in a similar vein as we did when someone asked about, you know, the creators launching their teams. And I think it's an experiment. We're seeing teams try this for the first time now. And I think everyone's trying to create new revenue channels, but it all comes down to a lot of the same points Chris made, right? You can't be a creator and suddenly launch a product unless you have background on how to launch a product and how to run a brand and the logistics of it and all the other pieces that a lot of these creators might not have experience with. So I think the teams that do it, or the creators that do it and are being successful, have brought in experts from other industries that can kind of lead that for them while they're the face of the brand. I think Feastables is a great example of, you know, this stuff can be successful. You just need the right people alongside you building that as its own almost separate brand, separate entity. Chris, any thoughts?
You know what would be super meta? Would be using Misfit.gg's $20 million creative fund for a creator to go to them and launch an esports property with them. And then Misfits manages it from start to finish. That'd be really interesting as a project, like a single team, like a niche. You know what I mean? Like, I don't know, like in Crossfire or in like Free Fire or Mobile Legends Bang Bang or something like that, you know? That'd be pretty interesting.
I don't know if Justin's in here. I know he had checked in that he was going to join, but I love what the guys at Misfits are doing and everyone there. I think they're doing a great job, and they're one of the teams that are, you know, looking at things in a different way and trying to, you know, be smart about how they can be sustainable and profitable long term.
Yeah. Actually, if Justin's there or anyone else is listening, I'm just starting to work with an agency at the moment who has some gigantic Latin musical artists, and they're looking to start collabing with some stuff in the gaming space, and they're interested in launching some of their own businesses. So if anyone has a creator fund or is interested in that, feel free to hit me up. Happy to chat.
Cool.
Did that answer your question, Jamil?
Yeah, actually. So I think this is an opportunity also for a lot of esports organizations to start finding their own way of making sustainable returns. So it could be a blessing in disguise, you know, this whole situation that we're finding ourselves in, like the global economy and stuff like that. So yeah, you did answer my questions, and I'm excited to see how teams do adapt to finding different revenue models. It's going to be an exciting thing to see. Thank you, guys.
Awesome, man. No worries at all. No worries. Alex, that's it. We're done, my friend.
For now. We're done for now.
Yeah. The Florida man will continue.
we'll be going through the exact same conversation on Twitter next week. Said we're going to repeat this.
Hey, we probably should, huh? I probably should start doing these on Twitter. Get some different types of audiences on there.
Yeah, we can run it back at some point. See what's changed in a month or two.
Yeah, sounds good to me, brother. All right, thanks for the chat. Thanks everyone for joining in. We hit a good amount of listeners in this one too. It's not always about the numbers, but obviously it's something that people want to hear about, like what's happening on the inside. Because like you said, it's the world is on fire and it's doom and gloom in the headlines, but it's not always the case, and it's not always just esports' problem. It's sometimes, like you said, a wider tech thing, right? Meta's already laid off 10,000. They said they're going to lay off another 10,000. Twitter's laid off a bunch of people, et cetera, et cetera. So yes, esports teams have done stuff wrong, which I've highlighted in a bunch of these audio spaces and we highlighted today, but it's not the fact that esports is just dead and no one cares about it. That's obviously not true, but some things just need to change, and that's what we're going through right now, right?
Yeah. Exactly. Appreciate it from the start. Bye. Cool.
Yep. No worries, brother. Have a good one. Catch you later. And for everyone else, we'll be announcing our next week's one very soon. Got a different kind of guest, but got a guy who's making the ESPN for Gen Zs. And I've never talked to him before, so it'll be the first time. It'll be really interesting to have a chat. All right. Catch everyone later.
Thanks, everyone. Bye.